Welcome to the Reality and Brutally Honest Truth about Special Needs Planning. My name is Patrick Barbieri, Executive Director of Lab Collaborative. And with me, as always, co-host Trish Costa, who is a counselor in Lab Collaborative. How are you doing, Trish?
Good. Good morning, Patrick. Psyched to be here.
Two podcasts this week, huh?
I know. It's unbelievable. Like, it's awesome. Learning a lot.
That was a good one, though, don't you think?
Yeah, it was excellent. It's nice to end our week with another great one. So.
Exactly. But every time we do them, I feel like we learn so much, and we try to keep them to about an hour. But we could have kept them going on if we wanted to, and I felt like I'm jotting down these questions, but I don't want to make it more than an hour, so I guess we should
just see where it goes.
If it goes longer, it goes longer.
Yeah.
So, all right. So I'm going to give a little bit of an opening to how we came to doing today's podcast, because I'm really excited about this one. And it's funny, we always think about who we're going to have on and when, and we're thinking about different guests, and sometimes things just come up because they come up, and we say, that's a good episode for a podcast, so we take full advantage. And I also want to say, I'm starting to put out more of the podcasts that we have out there, and two podcasts ago, we did one on the Harvard Research Study on music that we were doing in Lab Collaborative, and it was a great, great project. If you want more information about that, I think that's episode 2, so go back and you'll get the lowdown on everything that we did and how we did it. It was great. So after that podcast, one of the people that we were interviewing, we started having a conversation a little bit right after the podcast, and she started telling me a little bit about her personal life with ADHD. And as we started talking, I said, would you be willing to come back and do a podcast just on this? Because what you're talking to me about, some of this, I've been to a lot of workshops on ADHD, ADD, and what I was hearing was really, really interesting. And I almost didn't want to hear it all at the time because, I knew what we'd be doing on a podcast. But the information and the passion that was coming out, I just felt would be tremendous information for the reason why we're doing this particular podcast. So I invited her back. She was one of the Harvard researchers that did the study with our students back in December. Her name is Jenna Kotler. And Jenna, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really appreciate it. I should start off. Last time when Jenna came in with her colleague, Jenna came in with a Bill Nye T-shirt, she started telling me her inspiration about Bill Nye, right?
Yeah, I love Bill Nye still.
That's great, yeah. And today she came in with her Spice Girl shirt.
Yeah, I wanted to show a different aspect of my personality, science, and also Spice Girls.
awesome. We like to be creative and let
Spice
it loose.
Spice Girls, yeah. I'm right with you.
So Jenna, welcome. Like I said, I'm really looking forward to this. Jenna and I have been trading emails just about how we shape this podcast, because I want you to tell us about growing up with ADHD, and certainly ultimately ending to adulthood. And some of the outcomes too at the end is that, when we take away, what are we as educators, parents, the community, can learn about some of the stuff that you'll be telling us to make ourselves better, because that's ultimately why we do this stuff and why we share. And there's a lot of perceptions out there, misperceptions, and as a Harvard researcher, I know you have a lot of data and you really look at that side of it too, so you're not just speaking on the emotion part, you're really backing this up by data, which is great. So that's the intro.
All right. That was a good one.
All right. Good. Jenna, first, if you can just start with who you are right now, what you're doing. I know you're at Harvard and you're going to school and you're going to be ending in about a year. You were just telling us before the podcast.
Yeah. So I'm working on my PhD now. I'm in my fifth year of what will hopefully be a six-year program. we'll see how it goes. I have a really broad area of research, but in general, what I'm interested in is evolutionary medicine, which asks questions about how, kind of in two directions. So first, how what we know about our evolutionary past as a species, how that can inform our understanding of health and disease, and then also how kind of these natural history of diseases that we understand really well, how that can inform us about our history as a species. Because obviously there are things we can't do the way we do them in mice. You know, we can't give people diseases or tweak around people's genetics and see what happens. But there are a lot of naturally occurring diseases that can kind of give us some insight into why these processes exist in humans. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in that because I like things that give and take in both directions. You know, I like the kind of basic science questions and the mm-hmm. understanding more about humans questions, but I also really like that aspect of being able to also kind of hopefully give back and apply some of the science to making a difference in people's lives.
You become famous. You write your books. We had a podcast twice.
Exactly. I'll buy the book. That's kind of interesting. I'm intrigued already.
So back to my introduction. You know, after our podcast, you had told me. You said, I have ADHD,
mm-hmm.
and started to talk about what it meant and how it affected you and. And we started getting into this conversation, and I guess let's start from the beginning. You know, as you growing up, and one of the first questions I wrote down, you don't have to answer exactly the way it is, but what was it like growing up? When did you find out that you had ADHD? So how did it start to manifest?
Yeah, so when I was a kid, I was diagnosed when I was in third grade by a teacher who called my principal and my parents and were like, I think that your daughter has a serious learning disorder, because every time I ask her answers to questions, she can answer them. You know, we can have conversations about the stuff that she's learning and she really understands it. But every time I give her an in-class assignment, you know, like a piece of paper to fill out, it comes back blank with like doodles on it. And I can like see her counting ceiling tiles, literally, like instead of doing the work. So she must have some kind of, you know, writing disorder, like a literary disorder. And luckily I had a really wonderful principal who was like, oh no, I've seen this before. Usually in boys, which is part of why maybe it was flagged as a learning disability instead of ADD. But I think what she has is ADD, and that's sort of how it started. I didn't, you know, really know anything about it. I went to testing and like, I thought it was fun. It's a lot of doing puzzles, you know, like they're like a lot of IQ tests and stuff. So like mostly I just had a good time. I was eight. I didn't really know what was science and what wasn't, but I love that idea of like finding stuff out about my body. Right. Like I loved, you know, getting tests done. I thought it was exciting. So I didn't mind it. I didn't know anything, you know, quote unquote bad could have come out of it or whatever. But so then it was ADD. Now I guess it's ADHD primarily inattentive, although I think there's a lot of gray area between all of those kind of sub-distinctions. And especially, like we can talk about later, especially if you're not in that kind of young white male category. There's even more blur kind of.
That was really interesting when you said we'll definitely talk about that.
So then I started, my parents wanted to try to not put me on meds if possible because my behaviors weren't so dramatically the issue. The main issues were like the focus and the attention. And so I was lucky that I grew up in Toronto, which is a big city, so I had access to a lot of alternative type therapies, and I did neurofeedback therapy. Which, sorry, I tend to talk too fast. Which I loved. It was really helpful. So they put these little, you know, electrodes on your brain, on your scalp. And then and they connect you to a computer, and then there'd be you have to train yourself to focus. So as you're focusing, either, you know, a fish would go around a maze or something would happen on the computer screen. And if you're doing well, the fish will move faster. And if you're having a hard time focusing, it will stop moving. And how quickly you succeed at those games, you'll get points. And then at the end of a month or whatever, you trade those in for toys. I got an air hog. It still was my favorite toy. It's like one of those airplanes that you pop off and it like flies. It's very goal oriented. A lot of the staff there, sometimes it would just be really sitting and trying to learn how to focus. Sometimes it would be going through your homework or teaching you other cool things, you know, so that you're kind of focusing on the content, but at the same time kind of training yourself on how to focus while learning content. So that was extremely helpful. They also went through a ton of stuff with my parents. Like,
how long did you do that for? Was it short kind of thing?
No, it was a while. At least a full school year, but I think probably longer. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But they also went through a lot. Actually, it must have been longer, because this in grade four, I remember them talking to my teacher and saying, like, the worst thing you can do to someone who's having, you know, behaviors for ADD, that are disruptive to class is make them go through the same, like, multiplication tables 1,000 times because she already knows how to do that. So there's nothing for her to focus on. So her behaviors are just going to get worse.
Interesting.
And so they did a lot of coaching with my teachers about better ways to, you know, punish me for bad behaviors, like writing essays, copying pages of a dictionary, because at least you're learning new stuff, right? So it helps you focus a little bit more than doing the same rote thing over and over. Or like writing lines was the worst. Like, it always just made my behaviors worse because it's like the same thing over and over.
So when you say behaviors, like, talk about that. So
So a lot of my, I mean, and this is part of being a girl, sometimes the behaviors are a little bit different, so it can take longer for them to be noticed. But some of the basic things are always the same. So I talk a lot. I talk loudly. I interrupt a lot. I have impulse control, which also can be, you know, talking to other students in the class and being generally distracting to others, which was really the main thing I would get in trouble for. But also things like, you know, if I saw something that I wanted, I would take it. And it wasn't because I was being like a jerk, you know, I wasn't a bully or anything like that. It was just, I had
natural,
no,
kind of,
I had no like delayed gratification understanding. And one thing that I really wish people understood about kids and adults with ADD more is how guilty you feel after when you realize that what you did hurt somebody, you know, that hurt somebody's feelings, or when you're a kid and somebody's coloring with something and you take it because you want it, right? Like, I was such a sensitive kid. I hate, I never was a bully or anything like that. And when I would realize after, when someone would explain to me how something I did could be perceived as hurtful, I would come home and cry. Like, I felt so guilty about it because I just had no control over it.
And where did you get that feedback from? It wasn't, was initially the student, or was from the teacher saying this is what the impact was?
Mostly it was, from teachers or from my parents, if it was after, after school activities or something like that, kind of walking me through it. Because I think it took so long before I was diagnosed to even understand that, like, my brain just worked differently, you know? Like, I just didn't have that fundamental basic understanding that not everybody is going to act the way I act. So to me, it was like, if you have something to say, say it. Like, I don't mind if you interrupt me. So, like, I'm, you know, so it's fine. That's just how the back and forth goes. And it's just when people, I mean, I even remember being a teenager when people were explaining to me, like, friends that, you know, when you interrupt, it gives the impression that what I'm saying is not important to you. And I felt so bad because that was not at all my intention. It was like, I have a thought, and if I don't share it, I'll forget it. So, like, now's when I'm going to share it. So usually behaviors like that. I do have some hyperactivity stuff. I fidget a lot. That was another thing that was helpful in training was I remember them teaching my mom how to go through, like, sleep time meditations with me because I had a headboard and a footboard on my bed, and I would stick my feet in between the mattress and the footboard and literally shake so that my body would, like, shake. And I didn't even notice I was doing it. And my mom would walk in and be like, you're never going to fall asleep because you're like a wind-up doll. And I was a terrible sleeper, and I'm still a terrible sleeper. But it was really helpful to have them train my parents, who then trained me, in how to do these, like, you know, muscle retention and relaxation exercises or you know, meditations to help with bedtime, because that was just a nightmare. Like, it was terrible.
So, was it somewhat of a relief to you know, because you're so bright, obviously, and most if not probably a high percentage of any kid, male or female, who has ADD or ADHD are very smart.
Yeah.
It's the executive functioning and the attention piece. But, like, was it a relief when you actually knew what it was and then how to sort of start to understand it? And then your parents started to understand it. So at that point, were you in sort of like a model in school where they kind of designed or sort of took some of the strategies and helped? Were they able to implement those in your program at school?
Yeah, for the most part, they were.
Yeah.
I was in a gifted program in high school, which was good for not being bored, right? And doing interesting stuff, which really helped. A lot of my friends were co-appointed to, like, gifted and LD programs so that they were kind of getting both of those skills at the same time.
Cool.
I didn't do both programs at once, but my mom, so when I was 8, right around when I got diagnosed, she took a buyout from work so that she could be home, partly because she wanted to, and partly because I really needed the attention. Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit of both.
You need the guidance.
Yeah, and I really did. I mean, I remember when I was really small doing, like, math homework, I literally remember she would stand behind me with her thumbs in my ears and her hands beside my eyes, like, giving me, like, you know, horse blinders and, like, plugging my ears and holding my head to help, because that's not in, like, a... you know, yeah, mean focus. Way, just yeah. like I needed the help. I needed to, like, not be able to see anything going or hear, like, what was going on around me. So, I mean, I imagine that for her, it was a huge relief to help.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Have yeah. other people telling her, like, there's not something, you know, there is something wrong with your kid, but there's not something wrong with your kid. And, like, here are strategies that mm-hmm. will help. Because, I mean, I love my mother dearly and she's brilliant, but she's also not the most patient person naturally. So I think it was also helpful for her to have strategies to try.
Absolutely.
It could be a few. I remember her, like, snapping pencils in half, trying to, like, get me to do my homework because she was just so out, like, just had was out of options. Like, was like, I have tried everything that that would work for me. Like, I don't know what else to do.
That's the key. It's one thing for you to sort of go have your parents send you somewhere to sort of learn strategies. But it's sort of like, you know, there's that whole, all those other hours when you're in the home. You have to do the homework. You have to do the chores. So it plays out there, too.
Exactly. Totally. Yeah. And that personal life aspect of it is one thing that I was kind of hoping we might talk about when we talk about adulthood. Because most of the training that I got through school was about how to be successful at school, which is totally important, but not sufficient, you know, to cover the rest of what you're expected to do as a human being in the world. And so I think that is important. And then, sorry, I got distracted.
I actually think whatever you did it right because, you know, you're at Harvard.
I think sometimes when you talk about the impact on learning, that was one of my questions that I wanted, you know, is that, when you were 8 years old or 10, when you first found, you know, my question was, how did it impact your learning? Then I'm thinking as you're talking, was school boring for you? And did that exacerbate the problem to what was going on?
Yeah. I loved school. That's probably why I'm still in school. But it's one of the reasons why I'm so open with talking about the fact that I have ADHD is because people are always really surprised to find out that I have it if I'm going to, you know, be at Harvard or do a PhD or whatever. And I have talked with some, you know, prospective students, not necessarily through Harvard, but through the bigger community. You know, people know that I'm open about talking about it. And so if they have friends or family or whatever, they send them to me, talk to many people about it.
Yeah.
But it is hard because there's a lot of parts of graduate school that do not play to the strengths of ADD. And that can be really challenging. But it's also, it's possible, right? Like, it's doable. And I think that if people don't talk about the fact that they have these diagnoses and then have coping skills that allow them to be successful, then, like, nobody knows that that is a potential realistic aspiration, you know, or
path.
Yeah, and I mean, even, like, my academic advisors, they know because I've talked about it with them, and a couple of them have kids that are struggling with their own issues, and they were shocked, and I hope it was positive to be able to talk about it with someone.
That's what I felt so good about after we had talked the first podcast, that you'd be willing to be able to talk about your own life.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, that's what people are going to connect with.
Yeah.
As adults, you hear many more people starting to say, I had ADD, and I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
But nobody talked about it. This is great.
Yeah, it is. But at least, you know, in the work that we do with our students, you know, I mean, I feel like they're, for me, when I work with a student, you know, getting them to the point where, okay, you know, they're growing up and we're transitioning and they're going to go out into the adult world. One of my biggest things to teach them is, do you clearly understand how you learn? Do you know the strategies? Because that's what's going to make you successful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, now you say you're, whether they're in the working environment or in college, you know, college is still, a professor is able to just teach his class or her class the way they want. So it now becomes up to you. That's the huge self-advocacy piece about, hey, here's who I am. Here's how I learn. What do you think about this? But to be able to have those skills to do that, I think is something that, you know, we strive for in our students.
Absolutely.
You know?
And when my first year in college, I remember Skyping home to my mom and having her just do whatever she was doing on the computer because I was like, I cannot be left to my own devices. Like, I will not get my work done. And I needed her to just sit, you know, she works part time. She was like, you know, doing her work. Yeah. But I just needed to know that somebody was there kind of like, quote unquote, watching me just to feel like there was pressure to get work done. Yeah. And so I was lucky that my mom has a flexible schedule, you know, and could do those kinds of things. And then eventually I kind of figured out my own strategies that were helpful. But there are always days where I'll call home and be like, I've been trying to do the same thing for 4 days and I can't. I'm reading it over and over and nothing's going in my brain. You know, like, I'm struggling and we'll kind of brainstorm, like, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that. We used to call it the F word when I was a kid, focus. Like, to try and, like, you know, strategize on how to do that. And so it is really helpful. But there's also the other piece of, like, you don't want to feel stigmatized because of your diagnosis.
Absolutely.
So when you're asking about how I felt once I got diagnosed, if that was a relief, I don't think I really understood that I had ADD until I was a lot older. I mean, I knew it was a thing that I had, but my parents really, they took me to all the trainings and they did all the strategies and everything, but they really, like, did not emphasize that that was a thing that I had. You know, like, they didn't like to tell, you know, you could check the boxes when you send kids to camp about what issues that they have, and they didn't like to ever kind of introduce me that way because they didn't want people to expect
Label
less
you.
Of me.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I totally understand where they were coming from, but it was sort of a weird transition then because I was like, I know that there's something else. I have this other layer of whatever that I'm dealing with that other people don't necessarily have, but I also don't know how important it is. Like, how much should I weight it in who I am, like, what my personality, you know, like, there was kind of this, which I guess everybody maybe goes through growing up, and just having a diagnosis is one way of processing it. But yeah, so it was a thing we talked about at home, but my parents didn't ever kind of warn people that that was a thing about me before they met me until it was maybe an issue, and then they would talk about it.
So what was middle school like? I mean, you found this out in elementary.
Yeah.
Middle school is always, you know,
that's
girls.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. Tell me about middle school a little bit.
So I went to a very unique middle school, which was a really small private girls' school that was extremely liberal, like, feminist, kind of socially aware school, because that's what my parents are into. And part of it is because it was cool, and I met amazing people and learned these great things, and it was awesome. But part of it was because I had really low self-confidence in my academic abilities because I was smart and I understood the content, but I struggled so much with actually getting it done.
Right,
so it's different.
Yeah, the output of it, right?
Exactly.
Keeping up with the assignments, passing them in.
Totally.
You know everything.
Exactly. Like, if somebody wanted to have a conversation with me about what I learned in science.
I'm in the classroom full of those kids, yes.
Yeah, and
they're
that
bright.
Would have been fine, but having to actually, like, you know, hand in a little workbook about what you learned. Like, that was the part that was hard.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. there was nothing I liked more than an oral presentation because I would prepare, but I didn't really have to. I just stand up and talk about it and be excited about it. And
absolutely.
And I did have some teachers who would give me options to do, like, oral presentations or whatever if that was helpful. But for the most part, I just kind of struggled with it. So part of the reason that my mom wanted to send me to, or my parents wanted to send me to a smaller school, was to try and have more of that one-on-one attention and hopefully, like, build more confidence in how I apply the skills that I'm learning, you know, to know that I have them and that I can use them. And I do think it was really useful because after that, I went to this gifted high school, which was great, but it was actually a massive high school which had many programs, one of which was this program. So there were, like, 400 kids in my grade, which is the exact opposite of getting, you know, a lot of kind of hand-holding. And so I think that was really important to my skill building, but more just my belief that I had skills and, like, how to apply them. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. A lot of, like, my kind of more social behaviors came out in middle school, which is, like, you know, the risk-taking, the, like, impulse control stuff, all that kind of stuff that I feel like parents usually expect, like, you know, 17-year-olds to be dealing with that kind of thing. But my doctors told my parents, like, yeah, she has ADD. It's going to happen at, like, 12.
Yeah.
You know, like,
whatever
it is, expect it to be later. As my dad puts it, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know, happen earlier for kids that have impulse control problems and whatever. So that, I think, was more new to middle school.
Right. But was it a positive experience? Did you feel like you struggled through it or you learned more about
yourself? I don't know if anybody would say middle school was a positive experience.
Yeah, my daughter just got through it. And
I don't remember it.
Really?
Well, I mean,
maybe you blocked it out.
I definitely know it was not a positive experience. Yeah. It wasn't all that great.
Yeah.
I didn't really enjoy middle school, but there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I learned a lot from it. Like, now looking back on it, I think it was a positive experience, but I don't think anybody is ever having a great time, you know, full of 12 and 13-year-olds in one place.
True, very true.
Yeah.
And what we'll talk about kind of near the end when we talk about adulthood really kind of connects back to this and what you're saying, because when you wrote it in your email to me, I was like, wow, that really needs to kind of wrap this up into what you're kind of facing as an adult.
Yeah.
Just want to talk about, I said too, you know, one of the first times that I had seen an MRI, you know, of the brain of a person with ADD and someone without it, you know, one brain was highly colored and highly active and the other one was just a little bit of color. So obviously, you know, common sense says, well, the person with the more color in their brain is going to has, you know, ADD.
Yeah, like fireworks are going off all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in fact, the opposite is true.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was told is that because the one is highly colored, that's kicking in your executive function. As information is coming in, it's taken, it's compartmentalizing it, and you don't become overwhelmed unless, you know, everybody comes overwhelmed at some point.
Yeah.
But for somebody with ADD, they don't have that parts of their brain that is firing, so they have no way of putting it somewhere and compartmentalizing it. And was that explained to you that way? Is that familiar?
Yeah, so the executive function piece is actually, like, more recent to my understanding of ADD. When I first started reading those types of papers about, like, frontal lobe activity, it was explained to me on a spectrum where ADHD was one extreme and autism was on the opposite extreme, where folks with ADHD had really low frontal lobe activity and folks with autism had really hyperactive frontal lobe activity. And everybody was really puzzled by that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the explanation that was given is that basically I don't have enough activation going on in my frontal lobe, so I'm constantly seeking out stimulation to try and bring that back up to a baseline. Whereas somebody with autism who gets overwhelmed really easily and needs to be kind of socially withdrawn, it's because there's so much frontal lobe activity going on that they're kind of trying to push back and, like, bring things back down to a baseline. So one of the pros and cons or whatever, the issues with the DSM is that you can measure lots of disorders in lots of different ways. So I've seen ADHD on a spectrum with a whole bunch of different types of disorders. But that one with autism really makes a lot of sense to me, especially because I think social behaviors are a big player in ADHD that often doesn't get a lot of focus because it's not necessarily part of graduating school, you know, those kinds of things. But it does make a lot of sense to me on that kind of social spectrum with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And then that people were really surprised that giving, and we talked about this, but giving stimulants like Adderall or Ritalin to kids with ADD would work, because they were like, you're already a jittery, crazy person. Like, why would giving you uppers be helpful?
Right.
But the rationale was that it's increasing that frontal lobe activity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like, artificially giving you that stimulation so that you don't have to seek it out on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
we're having a cup of coffee.
Honestly, it makes a difference. Yeah, it really does help.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a mom talking to me who was like, I don't understand when I give my kid who's like has a lot of hyperactive behaviors, like a Coke, they're so much calmer after lunch.
Right,
and
it's
so bizarre to me. And I was like, oh, it's the caffeine.
Opposite.
It's really helpful.
Yeah.
Not that, you know, I advocate self-medicating for kids,
sure.
But I wasn't on any meds until I was in university, which is part of what Trish, you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
where when you take away a lot of those external control factors,
mm-hmm.
no matter how many skills you learn, it's just harder, right? There's just so much more that you have to deal with on your own. And my family is going through some health stuff at home, and there were all these kind of added layers of of extra things pulling at your limited executive function abilities.
Right.
That's when I started taking meds for ADD. And I started out using Ritalin just kind of as needed, like on days where I had a project I was working on or I had a lot of classes, and then I wouldn't take it on days where I didn't because I was just nervous about, you know, I'd never been on meds like that. And they have such complicated reputations in the press, and I wasn't sure how I felt about it. So I started kind of really small, and then when I came here that switched to Adderall kind of in the same small doses. I tried to take the long-term ones, but I hated it because I was too on when it was on, and then I couldn't come back down after, so I would, like, forget to eat all day because organization's not my strength, and you're I mean, they're appetite suppressants, so you're on these appetite suppressants all day. Then it would come down, and at, like, 10 p.m., I would eat, like, 3,000 calories because I realized I was shaking because I was starving, and then I couldn't sleep because I was, like, had just eaten all this food, so...
So that'd be a medication like Concerta or something like that.
Yeah, I was on the Adderall XR, but I think they're similar.
Yeah.
So I went back to the kind of 4-hour short-term ones.
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't love about them was that, and I do a lot of talking about meds to people who have small kids who can't tell how their kids are feeling about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a different experience for every person.
Sure.
But for me, it felt like somebody was like pulling one of those motorboat starters, you know, like I could feel my brain like click in, and then when it came off I could like feel it shut off, and it just felt really jarring. And I didn't like it. There were other parts of my personality that are tied into ADHD that I like, you know, like I am really bubbly, I like talking to strangers, like these are things that I like, and you know, my friends could tell when I was on my meds and when I wasn't, because other aspects of my personality would change too.
Right.
And I didn't really like that. But I was really reluctant to go on anything more permanent because it felt like somehow an admission of failure, like that you have to be on something all the time because you can't work hard enough to like fix it yourself.
Mm.
And I have a really wonderful psychiatrist who was saying, you know, I wear glasses, and he was like, it's like wearing glasses. You can survive in the world without wearing glasses, but it sucks. Like, it's really hard, you know? And the risk of failure is really high.
Absolutely,
So it's not that you can't do it, but it's that if you have something that can help make your life better...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Why would you not want it all the time? Like, you wouldn't take off your glasses when something is less important, right? Like, you would just... You want to see. Yeah, and I thought that was a really helpful analogy. So I started taking Strattera, which is a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. And it works similarly to an SSRI, where you have to have a baseline amount in your system all the time. And I like it a lot better because it doesn't feel like it's turning on and turning off, you know?
Right.
And because of that, I think the side effects are less noticeable, because it just becomes your new baseline of who you are. You don't have this feeling of, like, I'm being myself and then I'm not kind of all the time. So, yeah, so that's what I like, and I know, obviously, it's different for different people. It's definitely different for kids. Like, I don't have that experience.
Now, as far as alternative, I know you use the neurofeedback. You hear that a lot with people with anxiety now, since that's so pervasive, and it's... I don't know if it's coming back or if it's always been there, but you hear now people looking for other methods to learn it, so I've heard it quite a bit and read that, people try to... starting to use that.
The problem with it now, I think, is that it's just, it's not offered in that many places, and it's really expensive. So I have friends who grew up in rural areas who just, they had, their parents had no choice but to medicate their kids because there were no other options available to them. So that's why I was saying I was lucky that I was in a big city. You know, I think in, you know, Boston, there's probably a lot more options than outside of Boston.
Yeah,
so,
And just, this is just coming to me as I'm thinking. Meditation. Helpful, make it worse. Can you use it a little bit? Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful. I think you have to work to find one that works for you. So, like, I don't, you know, some people meditate first thing in the morning. The best meditation for me is to help me sleep.
Same.
Because I just, that's when my head starts buzzing, and that's what, like,
clearly.
Exactly.
And that's where I found it most helpful, is at night.
And so that really works for me.
If you tell me a little bit, what do you do? Do you?
Yeah, so UCLA actually has these free online meditations that you can Google. And they have one specifically for sleep that's like a body scan for sleep meditation. It's like 15 minutes. And I put it on almost every day fall asleep to it.
Yep.
I'm lucky that my husband could sleep through a nuclear holocaust, so like he doesn't notice. But it's very helpful.
Yep.
I know some people who use meditation in different ways. And I think it's just one of those things that's super personal. You have to, you know, find the one that works. That right. kind of muscle where you go through all your muscle groups yeah. and tighten and relax.
Tense and relax, yeah.
I've been using that since I was 10 right. and it still yeah. works.
That's great. That's great. I think I mentioned this to you last time when we were talking about the music. Have you used any of the theta waves or delta waves?
Yeah, yet? I don't know as much about that. Yeah, yeah, I think Alina yeah. was talking a bit about that yeah. last time. Yeah. I don't know that much about it, but I will also say that I'm not doing such active therapy now as I was when mm-hmm. I was younger, so I'm sure there's lots of new things that, yeah, yeah, you know, yeah. I missed.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of the, again, some of the guided meditations that you hear, mm-hmm. they seem to be incorporating some of these waves in the background, where okay. it's not, mm-hmm. they're not going up and down, it's just kind of the straight, supposedly it puts you, if you're sleeping, it kind of guides you into a sleeping REMs.
Yeah.
I don't know the science behind it, but it's kind of interesting. You know, sometimes I'll listen to them. It seems to be, you know, very relaxing. If I'm going to do a talk or something, I put it on in my car. It just kind of gets you in that
yeah.
mood.
Yeah.
You know, that's.
I know this might
balances.
Be.
Balances.
Yeah. I know this might not be a popular opinion for a scientist, but I kind of feel like it doesn't really matter why stuff works. If it works, just do it.
True,
you know, like placebo
true.
Effects are really strong. If I find out that I. You know, Strattera is really just a sugar pill,
mm-hmm.
but it's been working for me. Like, I don't care how many
right.
days.
It works.
So I kind of feel like that with meditation, that it works for some people, it doesn't work for other people. You kind of have to buy into it
mm-hmm.
for it to work. But I don't really, I'm not so bothered with what it's doing to my brain. If it helps me sleep, I would do almost anything to help me sleep. So I'm okay with it. Yeah.
So sleep is better for you at this point. You feel like you...
It's still
yeah,
hard.
It's still hard.
Yeah.
yeah.
Sleep is still... I think... That's one of those things that I don't tend to hear as much spoken about with ADD, but it's just hard. What you're talking about with anxiety, I mean, that's so comorbid with
yeah.
ADHD,
right.
and especially with women. So there was this article, and I think it was in the New York Times about a year ago, showing that a vast majority of women in North America that are diagnosed with ADHD, it's because they go to therapists for anxiety and depression as adults, and they find out that the part of the reason that they have all of these is because they've had this underlying undiagnosed
mm-hmm.
problem that they don't have any coping skills
mm-hmm.
for, that they've
right.
never been trained on.
Right.
And I think that's very real.
Sure,
and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
even
yeah.
if you do have coping skills,
yeah,
it
yeah,
still
yeah.
happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so a lot of the help for anxiety can also kind of
yeah,
help
absolutely.
With ADD.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so hard because, I mean, you hear about everybody having sleep problems, no
yeah.
matter what. It's so pervasive, and is it connected to this or not?
Yeah.
You know, who knows, but it's just a...
Yeah, I mean, we're so on all day long
yeah,
with
absolutely.
All
yeah.
our many devices, and we're and that's how it plays out for me.
Yeah.
It's like I just want to stop the noise so
yeah.
I can relax and come down, and that's where I have found it helpful. But you're right. I mean, there's definitely the correlation of anxiety, ADD, trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds
totally.
Of sort of overlaps to
yeah.
that.
Is
yeah.
that constant
so
checking of stuff? Like I had wrote about this a little while ago. You're constantly checking your phone. You're constantly
mm-hmm.
waiting for that email.
Uh-huh.
Constantly seeing that tweet. So your brain is sort of like neurofeedback is being trained to look for that information.
To wait, yeah, to anticipate the next
right,
thing.
So now it's gone, right? So now it becomes like, where do I get it? Where
yeah.
do I get that simulation?
That is interesting.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, that is how it feels.
And
yeah.
that's one
some
of the
days.
First things they told me to do was like, don't just put your phone down, like power it off so that you can't
right.
see the little blinking light,
right,
you
right.
know, and
correct.
Like... put it far away from your bed and, you know, whatever else, whatever else you need. There's this screen called Flux that you can get.
I have that. That is wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
I don't
really
know that.
Fun. It changes your phone and your computer. You know, it stops the
blue light
emissions.
Yeah.
So it helps
changes,
you sleep better.
Changes with darkness.
Yeah,
and light,
exactly.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So that's really helpful. But yeah, I've never hated anybody as much as watching my husband sleep soundly through the night. Like sometimes, you know, I accidentally elbow him out of reach that he can sleep and I can't. Yeah, I hate it.
Yeah.
I'm up. You're going to be up.
No, how dare you sleep soundly beside
right.
me.
Yes. That's funny.
So let's get into adulthood.
Yeah.
And also some of the other things that you were talking about with some of the definition of the disorder
mm-hmm.
and who it affects and who hasn't. And but you're talking about, you know, how as a kid, you know, it's obviously really hard, you know, no
yeah.
question about it. It's a struggle.
Oh, yeah.
But as an adult, it's just as hard. And some of the things that you didn't pick up as a kid or didn't learn, you know, don't know what we can call them. We tend to call them life skills or pragmatics.
Strategies,
and how that, how did that affect you as an adult with relationships?
It's really hard. And I think that's a thing. I totally understand the focus on getting kids through school, right? Most of these programs are run through schools. Mm-hmm. And it's important. You want to get, you know, school is the most important measure of success as a child. And I totally understand that focus. But I never had somebody kind of sit down and talk with me about the way that ADD would affect other aspects of my life outside of school. And so, yeah, relationships is one of them. You know, I compare myself, or my friends compare me to, like, one of those dogs that's, like, just too excited to be your friend, you know? It's, like, all, like, just wants to be all over you. Like, that's I'm super friendly and, like, too sometimes a problematic space, right? Like, people need their own space. They need to be able to not talk to you for a bit, and it's okay. And that's, you know, I come on very strong, and, like, I really want to love everybody all the time. And it's not, that's not super safe for you as a individual. And it sets you up for a lot of heartbreak of various types, you know, friendship or whatever. But B, it's not how adults interact generally in the world, right? And I don't think, and people never really kind of talk to me about it. And other things, like, I remember being on forums when I got engaged, because my now husband was like, you know, you don't ever remember the people that I talk about. Like, it's like, you don't, like, do you care about me? You know, you're not listening to these stories that I'm telling you. You don't remember them. And it feels like you're really self-involved, right? And it's not that I don't, it's just that I do not remember that we have ever had that conversation. And most of the forums are, you know, wives talking about their husbands with ADD, because that tends to be the direction. But they had a lot of strategies that were helpful, and stuff about money. Nobody talked to me about financial planning. And part of the problem of not being able to have, like, long-term, you know, vision for goals is that folks with ADD tend to be, like, hyper generous, and not in a tooting our own horn about how great we are as people, but, like, I can understand that you need this money right now. I'll just give it to you. And I don't have this, like, foresight into, like, I will eventually need this.
Right.
So it's a little bit different than sometimes the ADD symptoms overlap a lot with kind of pre-mania type symptoms in bipolar, and that's a comparison that gets made sometimes. It's a little bit different in terms of kind of the impulse control stuff, where in mania it's often, like, you know, buying a ton of stuff, you know, kind of thing. With
it's
ADD,
a risky behavior.
Exactly.
It's all those things, yeah.
And it is, I mean, there are risky behaviors and stuff associated with ADD, but in terms of the financials of it, it's just, like, a total lack of ability to have long-term goals.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal to learn that as an adult, and nobody ever really kind of talked to me about that. So there were a lot of wives saying, like, I have to be in charge of all of our finances.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't love and trust my husband. It's that, like, he literally doesn't have this mental capability of doing this, right? Like, he's not trying to be, you know, run us into the ground. It's like, there's no concept to how to do this. So that was something that I learned. And I think
the other thing you mentioned too, which I want you to, is how to act on a job.
Oh yeah.
Because we, with our, the students that we work with, and we're trying to get them ready to have a job. And that was something that I found interesting. If you could talk about that.
Yeah. It's still something I really struggle with, is, like, how social to be in the workplace. And I don't mean, like, should you be kind to your coworkers, but I mean, my dad owns his own company, and I remember him telling me a story about having to let somebody go because they just talk too much, right? Like, they were just always talking and nobody could get their work done. And it didn't matter that they were smart and a good employee. Like, it was bad for the rest of the workplace.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing that, like, when people are like, oh, it's good that you're social and it's good that you're bubbly, whatever, it is, but there also needs to be boundaries, and those professional boundaries look different than, you know, social, personal boundaries. And I still am not good at that. My basic strategy is just to tell people, like, please tell me to shut up. Like, I won't be offended. I know this is a thing I struggle with.
Do you constantly, like, do you, is it always sort of in your mind some places when you're less comfortable? Of course, obviously anxiety kicks in and that's a norm. But I mean, do you constantly in your brain always, are you self-monitoring always? Like, am I saying too much? Am I doing, because that's interesting. I feel like that for most people who don't struggle with sort of ADHD or even sort of autism, I always try to remember that. It's like, it's something that's sort of, it's naturally going on in my mind and I don't think about it. But for people who struggle with it, it's something they rehearse in their head all the time.
Totally. I had to become like consciously aware of it. It's not like my default, which is part of why I get really frustrated when people talk about, you know, ADD not being a real thing, because I understand statistically it is often overdiagnosed in boys and it's often overmedicated, and these are like conversations worth having. But saying that it's not a real disorder makes me so frustrated, because I'm like, do you think that this is just a ploy so I can be lazy? You know, like, don't you think if there was this easy solution to fix this, I would do it? Like, this is not fun for me. Like, it's like when you're anxious and somebody's like, oh, you should really try like relaxing. It's like, oh, thanks. I've never thought about that before. Like, you're so smart. So, and that's how I feel, is that part of the reason I don't have such available executive function is because I'm using that conscious space to be like, are you talking too much? Are you being too loud? Are you modulating your voice correctly? Like these basic, basic things that like kids do instinctively that I don't have.
I mean, it's a constant, you have to constantly manage it.
Yeah,
And I do like, and I'll get back to it. I like, because I've seen, you know, I've seen students be able to get to this point when they get older. You know, I think that one of the unique things about you is that you use humor, you know, like if you're, which is huge, you know, if you can say to a group of people, you know, look, I tend to talk too much. So if I am, just tell me, I'm cool with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's a skill unto itself, you know, that
it makes them comfortable.
It does. Right. And I had a student who I remember struggled, ADHD. And he said, you know, I think the biggest piece for me that was most difficult was the college dorm and how to sort of navigate all of that.
Yeah.
And when he got to the point that you're at, where he could sort of be comfortable and let kids know, look, I don't mean to, you know, get in your bubble or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that it helped him, and it helped everybody around sort of understand, like, you're not doing this to be annoying, you know?
Like,
you're really thinking about it.
And if anything, I'm so self-conscious about being annoying. I sit back and like replay it. Like,
I try to remember that.
Yeah,
it's hard.
There's times where we'll come home from like dinner parties or whatever, and I'll like sit my husband down and be like, was I being annoying?
Much?
Yeah, like, did I talk too much? Like,
I actually do that.
Some of it overlaps with other people. But we have like signals for being in public spaces, for being like,
there
you're not
cues.
Noticing.
We call those cues.
Yeah.
I love them.
Like, you're not noticing that you're shouting at everyone. Stop. My mom once got my ears checked because she was like, what? How do you not notice that you're so loud?
That's interesting. Yeah.
So, like, I need that because I don't understand when
do
I
have like these hand
voices.
Signals.
For I work really well with like physical containment. So usually it would be like squeeze my hand or like squeeze
That's
my
cool.
shoulder, because
I
need
like
to
those.
Feel like I'm being reined, like physically reined in. I know somebody once who was like, you would love a straight jacket, because that idea of being like held together is really.
Yeah.
See, I think when we first met, when we were doing the music study,
yeah.
you were explaining the study to us because we had no idea. We were excited about it.
Yeah.
So my perception was like, this person is passionate about this. So I got excited about,
mm-hmm.
wow, this is going to be very cool.
Yeah.
Secondly, she'll be speaking to our parents, our students. This is going to go over really well.
I'm really glad.
Yeah, so to me, you know, working as professionals, that's what came across to me. So I enjoyed that passion, you know, and really wanting to get into it, and the people that you would be meeting, I knew that you would be able to exude that passion to get them interested in what we were doing.
Yeah. And that's one of the things, you know, we talked a bit about like strengths versus weaknesses of ADHD. That is definitely a strength, is the raw enthusiasm for everything.
Yeah.
And not being afraid to talk to people and, you know, get to know people sometimes to overshare.
Yeah.
Those are things that help people connect with you. And I've been successful in a lot of the jobs that I've done that involve that. So I was a receptionist where I'm talking to strangers on the phone all day. It's like my dream job. And then when I started working in research, I was doing recruitment to get people involved in our studies, which again, you're being excited and you're telling people
that's
how cool it
right
is.
Right up your in your warehouse. That's what you do.
Exactly.
Right?
So it was
you
awesome.
Play to it.
And when I was reading a bunch of these forums, a lot of the people that were successful in their careers were like door-to-door salesmen and people like that, where you have to like not be afraid of people, not be afraid of rejection. And just, I'm going to like go in and charm your pants off until you stop by my vacuum or whatever, you know, like,
that's great.
And that is awesome. And I think that is definitely has helped me be successful. But I also wish that I had done maybe a little bit more conscious planning into what kind of careers would play to my strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this general perception, not just in ADD, but in general, like with all humans, that if you're doing something that comes easily to you, it's because it's easy. And if you're doing something that comes that doesn't come easily to you, it's because, you know, you have to try harder, right?
Right.
So it was this feeling that if something comes easily to me, I should be trying harder because I should be, you know, whatever, reaching my potential or whatever that means. And there's definitely some, you know, value to pushing and trying new things. But I think having a frank conversation with any kid about, like, what are your natural strengths how can you play to those would be really helpful, especially when you're talking about jobs, like careers. Because one problem with people with ADD is that they get distracted and they, you know, cycle out jobs every 4 or 5 years.
Right, right.
And that's the thing that I personally am really concerned about because I'm about to graduate university again, you know, whatever, for the millionth time. And I've been here 5 or 6 years. I'm starting something else. So I never, since elementary school, I've never done anything for more than 4 years. And it's scary, the idea of, like, having to pick something forever. And I know there's always this opportunity to, like, change and try something new. But you also want to feel like you can become an expert in something and, you know, move up the ranks and all this stuff. And that's something that I am talking a lot about with people about how to do that. Like, what skills do you need to keep being interested in something and keep learning new things in a job?
Right, right.
So that you can stick with it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. The other thing I just wanted, another positive to stay on that was, is that, you know, when you talk about you're not afraid to talk to people, you'd be a great salesperson, and that's awesome because I think, you know, a lot of us are people pleasers.
Yeah.
That's the scariest thing, you know. The scariest thing they say next to death is doing public speaking, you know, and that's kind of the things that you just get up there and do, and you're able to almost brand yourself in some ways because you're not afraid to do that.
I sold smoked herring and pickled eggs for a while at a food show, and my mother was like, if you can sell that, you're fine.
That's great. That's
good great. Practice.
But the other part is like believing, not seeing the barriers. So what I mean by that is because when we were talking about where we were going to do the study in our limited space where we had, we were trying to think in the moment, oh, we've got the space, how about this? And every time we were saying something, you're like, oh, we'll make it work. Yep, oh, that'd be great, that'd be great. Everything was positive. So we were kind of nervous. We were trying to make a good space for you to do some very important research study.
Yeah.
So in our minds, we're thinking about these barriers that wouldn't be as comfortable, but everything was great. And you would make it work. And it was just a positive mindset to...
Yeah.
So we walked out of there like, oh, we can do this.
That's definitely unfailing optimism. Definitely true. But I do think it... maybe has the opposite effect on, like, my mother, for example, you know, or my husband, really, because they feel like they have to balance me out, you know, they feel like I won't see the potential threats or barriers or whatever, so they need to be, like, seeking those out for me.
Right.
So I don't know if that, like, naturally those are the people that I navigate to or if they're filling those positions, but it is, I think it's nice. Like, I don't understand why you wouldn't go through life expecting things to be good, but obviously other people have different opinions. I read a study once.
I think it's refreshing. I think the energy with that makes things possible. So it puts people at ease. I mean, it's definitely a great strength.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically how I got to Harvard was I really liked my advisor's work. I saw him give a talk at my school in Canada, and I just kind of emailed him and talked to him about how much I liked what he did and ideas that we
passion.
Had. And
there
and I just kind of befriended his wife, and I feel like that's what you need, get in with the wives, and then, like, you know, and that's how it worked. And I definitely, not that I was ever stupid, but I wasn't, like, in that kind of top 1% that I would have gotten just based on, you know, an application alone without any kind of personal connection. So there are definitely times where that's extremely useful.
Well, some of the people I told that we're going to do this podcast, and so it's going to be on ADHD, ADD, and I think people's minds go to, oh, I wonder what problems that person has. So I go, they're at Harvard going for their PhD.
I think you're doing pretty well.
So it's like an immediate reaction in a positive way. Oh.
Yeah.
So I kind of did that purposely because I was trying to prove a point on what we were going to get across on this podcast that you can be extremely bright and can have the passion and be extremely successful. And I wanted that to come through because, you know, sure, other people struggle, but in this case, it's...
Also, you know, you're insightful, but you also, I feel like there was a piece intrinsically to you that wanted to understand and wanted to make sense of and then wanted to seek out. Totally. And that to me is like, that whole combination is probably why you're sitting in this chair right now so successful. Yeah. So it comes across, you know, and your ability to be able to communicate it is, I think... is awesome. It's definitely not a norm.
You can thank my many years of therapists who taught me how to do this.
Again, your willingness to go, right? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, sometimes there's a barrier to that. Yeah. That's the piece I'm talking about. You know, I hate to use that term, it takes a village, but in that sense, it kind of does. It's like all these pieces and I need to be willing to say, okay, you know, what else do I need to learn?
Yeah.
Because we're always learning.
And that is, another benefit to ADD, if you're going to be hypersocial with people who can teach you skills, right? And who, like, and it's nice to find someone else who understands how difficult it is, because it's so hard to explain to somebody that, like, yes, I could get an A in this project, but it takes me, like, three times as much energy as it takes you, and it takes me three times as long, and it's not that I'm not willing to do the work, but just explaining... trying to like communicate to somebody that it's not because I've been watching TV for 3 days and not working on this, or, you know, like
there is still a misconception. Oh, absolutely. Totally. Even though, you know, ADHD and ADD is so, it's something that is discussed and it's known. There still is a perception. I mean, I have friends who have, children, there's just such that, you know, they're lazy. They, you know, they can't, but they're also in models that are sort of not playing to those strengths. Totally.
And I feel that way about myself sometimes. Because when I say, oh, I have a tendency to do this because I have ADD, I'm like, you know, am I blaming that? You know, am I using that as a way to not have to, like, try harder or whatever? You know, like, it's very self-imposed, too. So it's definitely not just, I mean, it's probably from talking to so many people who don't believe it's a real thing. But it's hard. It's hard even in yourself. And then there's that line between, like, I can say that ADHD makes me more prone to interrupting people, but that doesn't mean I should just go around interrupting people, right? Like, I should still work on it. But like you say, that takes up so much conscious space that you can't fit in other stuff. And it's really difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of managing, but you do it well.
Thank you. That's part of why I want to talk about it, because I feel like I'm in this kind of, I don't know, place of privilege, right? Like,
yeah,
I
absolutely.
So I feel like I should be more open about how hard it is to get there.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Now,
the other, you emailed me this and I cannot explain it, so I'm going to kind of introduce it. Sure. You got to take it off. Is about the research on ADHD and kind of how it was based on the original definition of the disorder and so on. So if you can kind of explain that, because that was to me something that I did not understand.
Yeah.
And I thought that was great to share with people.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so, I mean, part of all disorders is how much of it is based on evidence and how much of it is based on kind of professional experience and all this stuff. So when ADHD was first defined, it was defined using white boys aged 8 through 12. So the behaviors that were considered typical and diagnostic were behaviors that were common for that age group. And then more recently, it was expanded to include white males up to age 18. So, you know, a lot of diversity. Yeah. And so a lot of the behaviors that are considered like stereotypical ADHD behaviors have to fit kind of within that space, or else they don't get noticed. So that's why so many women go undiagnosed, is because the way that we socialize and the types of risk-taking behaviors of girls are less likely to be getting into fistfights and more likely to be other stuff, you know, promiscuity or drug use or whatever, which might overlap with male typical behavior but might not, and also gets into that kind of moralistic zone, right, of like, I don't know, of trying to teach girls more feminine behaviors. So that's part of the problems that often happen, is that when you're presenting as ADHD, you're presenting as like not female typical sometimes in your behaviors. And so there's all this kind of gray area that's happening. But the other problem is that it means that statistically, when boys that aren't white are presenting with those behaviors, they are much more likely to get diagnosed with like oppositional defiant disorder and other types of disorders, and then sent to things like juvie more than things like therapy. So there's a very complex issue going around here. And I talk about this with autism too, where autism is based so much on social behaviors and it's, you know, heavily male biased. And there might be some biological reasons for that, but there might also be that it was diagnosed in male typical social behaviors. And the way that women socialize, we know, is different. Not better or worse, but just different. Okay. And this is part of why I like this evolutionary application here, is that there's a lot of evolutionary psychologists who are interested in, you know, why women's social behaviors are different. Like, where does that come from? So women had to form cooperative communities for alloparenting and childcare and gathering food, because that was most of the calories for your families. It doesn't come from hunting. It comes from gathering. So we had to kind of coordinate in this different way, whereas men were going out and hunting in these big hunting cohorts, and their cooperative, you know, strategies would be different. So, for example, like, women can hold grudges and gossip and stuff like that when you're gathering, because it's not necessarily like an immediate life or death situation. And it's more important to know background information about people who might be taking care of your babies, right? So you want to have kind of more of that social reputational stuff going on. Whereas men who are hunting, you might not be able to afford to hold a grudge because you could die. Or going to war, you know, warring with a neighboring village or whatever. Like, you could die. So you're more likely to kind of fight it out or whatever and then move on. And so I think that, you know, these are just theories. They're just hypotheses right now. But I think that it does give a good basis for understanding how social behaviors differ and why. And that those are going to then be important when we think about diagnosing disorders that are based largely on social behaviors.
That's interesting. That is very interesting. I mean, that's almost like a topic.
That's a
in
whole
itself.
Other podcast. I mean, no, that's really, interesting, I mean, though. I mean, yeah. And that's the science, you know, and the evolution of, you know, taking a look at how that connects. And you know, just because it's, you know, like in the DSM-5 now doesn't mean it's can't be, you know, changing.
Okay.
Take another look at it. That's interesting. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying, you know, to take, like, cut out people who we think have autism or ADD or whatever, but just that by broadening the definition, you'll be able to help more people,
right?
You know, reach
that
more people.
That go undetected.
Yeah, because for as many skills as, like, I wish I had as a grown-up, I really was able to get through school because of the treatment that I had when I was young, right? And the skills that I learned and having a mom who was able to pour a lot of time into helping me graduate. And I still use all those skills now. And so, you know, people who don't get that training, it's really hard. Yeah.
So what are you going to do with all this information? I mean, I think it's so inspiring in some sense, like, to share it, but also you're coming to these conclusions. I mean, you do a lot of thinking about it and you're putting these pieces together. And like I said, I've never heard it explained this way. And I've gone to many workshops.
Yeah.
And some of the beginning stuff we talked about, but now it's kind of going into a different realm.
Yeah.
Where who knows what the evolution of understanding all of this is about. So to me, I'm trying to take all this in.
Yeah.
Thinking about what you just explained. And but again, you're inspired by it because it does make a new sense. So
cool. Well, I start by doing this. What
I would love to have you do is I don't know, after you're done with your schooling, if you'll still be in the area, but love to have you come in and speak to our staff.
That'd be great.
Sure.
Because for them, we're lucky that we get to hear, we get to share the podcast, but I think actually, you know, having you do it live in front of people just adds that other element to it that you can't do through a podcast.
I mean, I clearly love talking. Who doesn't love talking about themselves, right?
No, but it's
inspiring. I think when you hear it, I think people immediately have that. You have somewhat of a connection to lab because of the research you do, than this. But now it's like we're learning something here. We need to share it.
I totally agree. I mean, as you were talking, you know, I'm thinking about the work that I do. I'm thinking about my students who struggle. And I'm actually thinking about some kids who I'm like, you know, I feel like they've been told, oh, you know, she's so social and she can't focus but never had a diagnosis of ADHD. So then it sort of, you know, makes me think about that. And then it makes me think about, you know, oh, it validates some of the stuff I am doing because that's so important in the end product. So it would be really great for you to come and speak and share.
And I'm sure that, I mean, your kids are extremely grateful that you guys do the work that you do and that you care about learning about, you know, doing it better, because I definitely wouldn't have been successful. My grandmother used to joke that she was surprised I didn't fail out of high school because it doesn't matter how much potential you have, right, if you don't have those strategies or coping skills or whatever to implement it.
Yeah.
So, but also to hear about, you know, struggling with ADD and having, you know, talking about the life skills that, that you didn't get as an adult, because we do try to talk to that with parents and say, these things are so important and it's not done in a couple of years, you know, and when a student leaves us at post 22, you know, the kind of the teaching is done, they're on their own, unless a family is going to go on their own and continue that, but it's so important that they understand that they need to learn.
There's also
skills.
A lot of resistance. Like, I didn't want my parents to keep teaching me when I was in my 20s, right? Like, I'm done. True. I'm an adult. Leave me alone.
Right.
But so it's important to get it in there while kids are still willing to listen to you.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything that we didn't ask you that you want to share? I want to continue thinking about this because I know there's another podcast in there about something else because it's so important. Anything else that you can think, Trish?
No, I mean, I think when your research is, you know, is complete and it's done, I really would like to hear your findings. And
totally.
We have to figure out how to connect on that. But I would love to have you come and speak to the staff.
Cool.
It's inspiring. It poses a lot of questions. And you definitely, like I said, you have so much passion for the subject.
Thanks. Well, I'll do my best. I hope I'm a good representative of other folks, especially girls with ADD. That's a thing. I guess that I would want to say is that when I was a kid, you know, we would read about people who had ADD who were successful, and usually they were athletes and boys, right?
Like,
sometimes they were musicians or other creative types, but we never learned about like lawyers or, you know, like people who had kind of more academically inclined jobs. And secondly, I didn't know any women who had ADD, none. I didn't know other girls in my program who had ADHD, and I did not know any adult women who had ADHD. Which made me feel more weird, right? Like, I felt like my behaviors already were a little bit boy typical, and then I didn't know any other girls who kind of acted the way I did.
Right.
And sometimes it's fun. I like being a little unique and weird, so I didn't mind. But it's nice to have role models that,
absolutely,
you know, you can look up to. And the other thing, I think, is that anybody who loves anybody with ADD is to, remember what we were talking about, that they're really consciously trying to do it, and that there's a lot that you can learn about it to make you a better partner or sibling or whatever with it. So, like, you know, my husband started reading these online boards. He came with me to therapy a couple times just to ask basic questions, right? To, like, learn. He never interacted with anybody who had the disorder who wasn't a 12-year-old boy on Ritalin, right? Like, that was, like, the only... That was his image of what it was like. And it makes a huge difference, because it feels good to have somebody appreciate the amount of effort that you're putting in, right? To recognize that even when you're not being totally successful, that, like, you're really trying.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone can relate to that.
Absolutely.
And just the things that I have to try at are a little different than things other people have to try at. But, yeah.
That was well said.
Thank you.
Jenna, thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
So nice meeting you.
I can't
wait
to publish this. I just think that people listen to it will just get so much out of it. So I really appreciate you coming. And
anyway, have
good luck in the yard.
Let me know.
In Harvard yard.
Thank you.
I wish I was there. That would be fun.
You can come visit.
I know.
I work in the museum. I'll give you a tour. It's really fun. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.